I think they'll be able to work this out pretty effectively. That satisfies all concerned here.
A judge rules that independents can run in the Democrats' primary. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, October 17th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, lawmakers plan a meeting on oil taxes in Anchorage, but not at the LIO.
The point is that the more everybody's on the same page, the more productive the conversations can be.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities and in the 40 years of Alaska operations.
And by
support for Alaska Public Media comes from GCI Business, with complete GCI data solutions for Alaska's most important organizations. GCI is your partner in possibilities.
Ensure the vitality of public radio by including it in your estate planning. Together, we build a sustainable future for quality media. Thank you.
A judge today ordered that independents can run in the Alaska Democratic Party primary, ruling in the party's favor. It's not clear whether independent Governor Bill Walker will run in that primary. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports on what the ruling could mean for next year's election.
Juneau Superior Court Judge Philip Pallenberg wrote in his order that political parties have the right to associate themselves with the candidates of their choice, regardless of their party registration. The Alaska Democratic Party tried last year to allow nonpartisan or undeclared candidates to run in its primary, but state election officials rejected the change. The party filed a legal challenge this year, which led to Pallenberg's order. Party Executive Director Jay Parmley says he's pleased with the order.
We've long believed that we have the right to allow people to associate and participate in the party, regardless of registration, and today the judge confirmed that.
Governor Walker said when he and Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott filed for re-election in August that they weren't planning to run in a primary, but the order could make it an option. Lindsay Hobson is Walker's daughter and campaign spokeswoman. She says the campaign has no comment on the order.
Well, Governor Walker and Lieutenant Governor Mallott have an ongoing duty to uphold the laws of the state. And since this is a pending legal matter to which the state is a party, the candidates can't comment at the time.
Lawyers for the state had defended a law that requires primary candidates belong to the party holding that primary. Pallenberg wrote that the state failed to place sufficient faith in the ability of voters to make informed decisions. Assistant Attorney General Corey Mills says the Department of Law would decide whether to appeal the order.
We are still reviewing the decision, but we will engage in our normal appeal evaluation process.
This decision to appeal can take 3 to 5 weeks. One major question is how the name of an independent candidate who wins a party primary will appear on the general election ballot. Pallenberg wrote that state law requires the general election ballot inform voters that an independent primary winner is the Democratic nominee. He also wrote that state officials will ultimately determine the design of general election ballots. The Democrats had changed their party rules, so it appeared possible their primary winner could appear on the general election ballot without the party's name. Now, Parmley says the ballot should reflect both the candidate's party registration or lack of registration, as well as the fact they won a primary.
I think they'll be able to work this out pretty effectively. That satisfies all concerned here.
Alaska Republican Party Chairman Tuckerman Babcock says he's glad the decision upholds political parties' freedom of association. He adds he believes the Democrats hope to nominate independents without having the party's name listed next to the candidate on the ballot.
I mean, if they want people to seek the Democrat nomination, there should be some recognition on the general election ballot that that's what the person did.
The deadline to register for the August primary is June 1st. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Tomorrow is Alaska Day, a state holiday, but some lawmakers and their staff will be meeting all day to get a crash course on oil taxes. It has become somewhat of a habit for Alaska's legislature to wade into a fight over the state's oil and gas tax system. There have been 7 major changes to the tax system over the last 12 years, and each time the issue has been bitterly divisive. Now lawmakers are gearing up to go at it again next January, but first members of the House and Senate are trying to make sure that everyone is speaking the same language. Anchorage Representative Democrat Garen Tarr will be leading an oil and gas tax working group. Her office helped to coordinate the meeting.
The point is that the more everybody's on the same page, the more productive the conversations can be.
To that end, they'll hear from consultants and an advisory board made up of members of the industry, analysts, and state regulators. And the meeting is public, sort of. State law requires that the public must be notified if there are more than 4 lawmakers present, but it won't be easily accessible. There's no way to call in. The Legislative Information Office is closed on the state holiday, so the meeting won't be streamed like others during the legislative session. Instead, they're holding the meeting at the BP Energy Center in Anchorage. There will be a webinar, but lawmakers haven't shared that registration publicly. The meetings will be recorded and available for viewing at a later date. Tarr says she doesn't think anyone will mind if members of the general public show up, but the meeting isn't geared toward them. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, heroes or vigilantes? A group of Anchorage citizens track down stolen vehicles, but the police aren't happy about it.
Right now, the cops are pulling up. We've been sitting on a stolen Chevy truck that was stolen last night or early this morning.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein. Attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Older Persons Action Group publishes Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide publication for seniors, and is an excellent source of information for families and caregivers. SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
That's the Akrishkuk Dance Group performing an invitational song on stage at the second day of this year's Elders and Youth Conference in Anchorage. Today, the keynote address came from Claire Swan, a Dena'ina Athabascan elder from the Kenaitse tribe on the Kenai Peninsula. Swan's speech focused on the changes she's seen in her lifetime, including the effects of commercial pressure on subsistence fishing and population growth in South Central Alaska. But Swan told the younger generation much of their work remains the same as decades ago.
The world is very different, and being a teenager today is very different from the time I was. You walk the same, we all walk the same paths. And you guys, wherever you go, wherever you build, there's a Dena'ina word, it's sustin. It means breaking trail. You will always be breaking trail for the rest of the people to come.
There were sessions focused on regional and language issues, as well as workshops on topics as varied as moose hide tanning and cedar weaving to suicide prevention and college prep. The audience also heard about a change in security protocols at this year's AFN, which kicks off on Thursday. AFN board member Georgiana Lincoln says there will be metal detectors at the entrances of the downtown Dena'ina Convention Center.
The board wanted us to have a safe and productive convention, but one where we know that we're in a safe environment. And unfortunately, with what's happening around the world, outside of our native communities, we oftentimes don't see that.
AFN's Director of Communications, Jeff Silverman, clarified that the decision to install metal detectors was made by the Dena'ina Convention Center. He added the move isn't a response to any specific threat, but was a sign of the times. Items prohibited will include explosives, alcohol, drug paraphernalia, as well as noisemakers and signs bigger than 14 inches. There will be exceptions for elders and artists entering the building. Attendees are warned there could be long lines on Thursday morning. Today also saw the launch of a new political group meant to bolster Native influence in elections and legislation. The new entity, Native People Action, aims to ensure traditional values are reflected in tribal federal, local, municipal, state, and federal government. Executive Director Grace Singh says part of the group's focus is mobilizing new voters on issues of public safety, education, and aspects of traditional life like subsistence. The 34th Annual Elders and Youth Conference wraps up tomorrow. President Trump has nominated an Arctic Slope Regional Corporation senior executive to be the Assistant Interior Secretary for Indian Affairs. Tara McLean Sweeney is the first Alaskan ever selected for the position, which oversees the Bureaus of Indian Affairs and Indian Education. Her nomination has Alaska's U.S. senators literally cheering.
We're half, half happy. What a fabulous, fabulous nomination.
Super well qualified.
Sweeney is a graduate of Barrow High School and Cornell University. She's Vice President of External Affairs for ASRC and a past co-chair of the Alaska Federation of Natives. Until this spring, Sweeney also chaired the Arctic Economic Council. Senator Lisa Murkowski says she led international efforts on broadband and shipping.
She is at a level as an Alaskan that is just enviable. And I think, again, we could not have identified an individual who has a broader perspective, including that of coming from the ANC side.
Senator Dan Sullivan sees the nomination as part of a trend that will put Alaskans at the helm of critical agencies for the state. Sullivan points to Joe Balash, nominated to be an Assistant Interior Secretary with sway over public lands, oil and mining. Also Chris Oliver, head of NOAA Fisheries, and now Sweeney.
A big part of our job is educating our colleagues and some of the federal agencies on unique aspects of Alaska. Now we have Alaskans running these agencies for the country, and Tara Sweeney is going to be phenomenal.
David Solomon, a Gwich'in activist from Fort Yukon, is happy too.
Oh, it was awesome. It's good to see our Native leader being in front line now, as we've been recognized.
Solomon spoke outside the U.S. Capitol, where he's been working to rally opposition to drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. ASRC owns subsurface rights in the refuge, and Sweeney has been a lead advocate in favor of drilling there. But Solomon takes a broader view and says Sweeney's selection is good for Alaska Natives. The position requires Senate confirmation. A member of Governor Bill Walker's cabinet is taking a key position at the Environmental Protection Agency. The agency confirmed today that Chris Laddick will become the regional administrator overseeing EPA's work in Alaska, Idaho, Oregon, and Washington. Laddick is currently commissioner for the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. The Walker administration announced that Laddick will step down from that post on November 1st. He will take the reins at EPA Region 10 in December. Before joining Walker's cabinet, Laddick spent over two decades working for communities in rural Alaska. He was city manager for Dillingham, Unalaska, and Galena. While Laddick was Unalaska's city manager, he was involved with reaching a settlement with EPA related to Clean Water Act violations from its wastewater treatment facility. At EPA, Laddick will oversee regulation of a wide range of activities in the Northwest, from Superfund sites to the proposed Pebble Mine. Governor Walker announced that outgoing Kenai Peninsula Borough Mayor Mike Navar will take Laddick's place as Commerce Commissioner. U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan has hired Larry Burton as chief of staff. Burton grew up in Alaska and worked in the offices of Congressman Don Young and the late Senator Ted Stevens, as well as in the executive branch. He also worked for BP for 17 years. Sullivan says Burton is well-versed in Alaska issues and also understands Washington, D.C. Burton replaces Joe Balash, who has been nominated to be Assistant Secretary of Interior. With a surge in vehicle thefts in Anchorage, some residents are taking matters into their own hands. One group mobilizing through Facebook is reuniting stolen vehicles with their owners. Members of the A-Team, as they call themselves, say they are filling a void left by overworked police. But as Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove reports, it's not that simple.
It's late afternoon in a quiet neighborhood of single-family homes on Cobble Creek Circle, and Floyd Hall is staring at a maroon pickup.
Right now, the cops are pulling up. We've been sitting on a stolen Chevy truck that was stolen last night or early this morning.
Hall is 52 and sports a dark gray beard and a baseball cap. He's the heart of the A-team. Some call him a hero. Others say he's a vigilante. Either way, he's got this down to a science.
We're sitting across the cul-de-sac from it, so we try to stay inside of it so we can watch it.
There's only five people on the A-team. The A stands for Anchorage, by the way. But many, many more people feed them tips via Facebook. And there is plenty to keep them busy. Police say there have been over 2,000 stolen vehicles in Anchorage so far this year, already surpassing the number of stolen cars last year and more than double previous years. Hall says the A-team has recovered about 30 vehicles in the past 18 months or so. The case of the maroon Chevy Silverado is a perfect example of how the group works. The owner posted a photo of the pickup to the Facebook group Stolen in Alaska. Less than 24 hours later, a woman who follows the page saw it parked in front of her neighbor's house. She called police and also, in her own post, let the Facebook group know. The pickup's owner saw the post and messaged Hall. Hall arrived a half hour before the police. So here we are with him and the Chevy sitting on it, as they say.
If someone's in it, we call APD 911 and let them know it's occupied. But most of the time they're not occupied and we let them know that, you know, we're close by watching, you know.
Hall says he saw a man run away from the house earlier, but he's gone, and at this point, there's nobody for the police to arrest. Hall is low-key, but he's been in some pretty hairy situations before.
We try not to confront anybody. It's about getting the vehicles back, you know? Let the cops confront the people.
Do confrontations happen?
I was shot at probably a month ago, but I'd followed a stolen vehicle.
As he's talking, Hall's eyes are on the two police officers looking over the Chevy. One officer walks over to Hall's fellow A-team member, Chad Martin.
Well, I want you to just put your hands on the car for me. I'm just going to take that firearm off of you for right now, okay?
The officers remind Martin that, by law, he was supposed to tell them about his handgun, the one in the holster on his hip. Police Sergeant Jason Allen takes Martin about 20 feet away. Martin seems confused.
What's this all about, sir?
I'm a little concerned about your group and about the fact that you guys are armed and you're not notifying police officers about
that
it.
That is my fault.
Answer the question.
The discussion goes on for a few minutes, and Sergeant Allen eventually lets Martin off with a warning. Their conversation, though, gets at something bigger. Remember the car chase Hall described? Well, the only charges in that case are for reckless driving, and they're filed against him. Police say Hall chased the car going more than 60 miles per hour in a 25-mile-per-hour zone on a one-way street, heading the wrong way. It was near where a kid's soccer team was practicing. The charges don't mention any gunshots. Still, that's the conundrum with the A-team. They're helping get back stolen vehicles, but police say what they're doing is risky for themselves and innocent bystanders. After saying this to Martin, Sergeant Allen refuses to talk to me. But his boss does agree to talk.
Chasing down suspects is not... it's not helpful. It actually, in a lot of ways, creates more work for the police department.
This is Police Chief Justin Dahl. Dahl says he understands the frustration over vehicle thefts and why people might support what the A-team is doing.
But I don't think that support's going to last if one of those people hurts or kills some innocent people who are going about their daily routine and aren't involved at all.
Dahl says tips on stolen vehicles or other property should be sent to the police so they can handle it. Dahl also says the department is growing its ranks, at least in part to decrease response times. But he says even with more officers on the streets, police will always respond to crimes that threaten people before crimes that threaten property.
I get that.
This is Floyd Hall again.
I'd rather them go to be on a shooting or a domestic violence than an unoccupied stolen vehicle. They're doing what they can. You know, I've got nothing against APD. They're great guys.
But Hall says the police simply cannot keep up with the volume of stolen cars and trucks. I have to ask him, though, why does he feel the need to do this?
Why not? You know, I mean, do what you can. I was raised to do what's right, you know, I guess.
And it appears for now the A-team has no plans to stop doing what they think is right, even if the police disagree. In Anchorage, I'm Casey Grove.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
Would you like to play an integral part to what you're listening to? Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. If you are already a member or corporate sponsor, we thank you.
If you'd like to become a member or sponsor, it's really easy. Start with a call to this station or visit us at our website.
The new PBS documentary by Ken Burns and Lynn Novick on the Vietnam War takes a look at a conflict fought decades ago that lives on for many veterans to this day. As part of the series, we're looking at how Alaskans experienced the war. Former Democratic Governor Tony Knowles enlisted in the Army during the mid-60s, just as the war began escalating. Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes has this story of how Knowles' opinion of the war began to change after he returned to civilian life and the parallels he sees in today's conflict with Afghanistan.
In the early 60s, most young men in America expected that at one point or another, they'd be drafted into military service.
After I got to college, I proceeded then to get kicked out for both academic and disciplinary reasons.
During an interview with Alaska Public Media, Knowles says he was working on an oil rig in Colorado, and as winter started bearing down, he figured he might as well enlist.
I'd always wanted to be a paratrooper, so I decided I'd join the Army, get in the paratroopers, and see the world.
At 21 years old, Knowles served in an intelligence unit for the 82nd Airborne. He arrived in Vietnam in the fall of 1964, when there were only about 10,000 American military and civilian personnel in the country, serving mostly as advisors to the South Vietnamese. Knowles says his role was using satellite imagery, infrared, and other technological tools to figure out where to drop bombs.
Initially, what we were looking for was areas that could be bombed with the belief that we could win this war without committing a lot of ground troops. That didn't turn out to be that successful.
By the time Knowles' tour was over, the military was gearing up for a very different kind of war in Vietnam. There were now 200,000 troops in the country, no longer just as advisors, but many directly fighting the North Vietnamese. Just as Knowles was leaving in the fall of 1965, a major operation in a combat zone revealed an extensive number of tunnels, caches of weapons, and enormous stores of food, provisions for the enemy's war effort. It made Knowles realize the Viet Cong were vastly more established than he'd been led to believe.
It really brought into question of whether technology could win the war, and as we found out, it didn't.
As he transitioned out of the Army, Knowles felt his confidence in the military's mission and the country's infallibility erode. At that point in the mid-60s, the nation's attitude towards the war wasn't yet as polarized as it would eventually become. But back at college, Knowles says the information coming in through the media and from the government about the war's progress didn't mesh with what he'd personally seen during his deployment.
It seemed to be that what you heard just didn't represent the truth. And so you said, well, what are we doing there? And what is it doing to us with the Americans who are getting killed? How many Vietnamese are getting killed? And what is the purpose?
According to Knowles, what really changed the national opinion of the war was the draft. That, he says, spread skepticism across families in every part of the country, particularly once the lottery system was introduced in 1969.
You were going to be drafted, and so that made people think, no, why are we there, and why is my son or my brother or my father going to that war? Without that, it distances the public then from what the military is doing.
That distance is one of the reasons Knowles thinks the U.S.'s war in Afghanistan, which has eclipsed Vietnam as the longest-running conflict, has consumed the better part of two decades. Whereas draftees generally did one tour in Vietnam, today's volunteer military is filled with a smaller number of people deploying to combat over and over.
We have people, and I know friends, that have served 3 and 4 or 5 tours. So you have a military that the general public doesn't think about very much because they don't have cousins and relatives and uncles and involved in that war. It's just a much smaller group of people that are doing that.
Knowles sees many of the mistakes of Vietnam being repeated in Afghanistan, an over-reliance on technology, working hand-in-hand with a corrupt regime, and a murky sense of what troops are actually fighting for. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
For more about Alaskans who served in Vietnam, you can find videos and stories by visiting alaskapublic.org/Vietnam. Igiagig is more than halfway through their local foods challenge. The village decided to try eating only locally produced food for 6 weeks when the students read about a similar project in Australia. They also incorporated a traditional hike into the challenge. About 24 adults and elementary to high schoolers took on the backpacking trip that was almost the distance of a marathon. They kept up the food challenge along the way. KDLG's Avery Lill has more.
Big Mountain is a traditional meeting place between people from Igiagig and Kakanak. It's a 23-mile hike from Igiagig. There was no dehydrated camping food to lighten the packs of the backpackers who braved the 4-day hike in the wind and rain. Since the walk was a part of the food challenge, their packs included moose, dry fish, and fresh produce. Kaylee Hill is an Igiagig 8th grader who finished the hike.
It was tough because some of us had to carry like apples and heads of lettuce and stuff like that instead of just packing like Mountain House.
All seem to agree that one part of the trip was the hardest. Tate Gooden was one of the adult leaders on the hike.
Everybody had to swim across Belinda Creek, which was part of the climax of the trip. That was our biggest obstacle. After walking most of the day along the beach, it was flooded due to the wind. So we were walking through waves. We were already wet. And then at the end of the day, we had to swim across a frigid creek. It was a little daunting, but everybody rose with the occasion.
The first group that swam across got a fire going so everybody could dry out quickly. The sun came out on Saturday for the final stretch of the hike. They celebrated with a traditional foods feast at Big Mountain, which folks who'd stayed behind in the village were able to bring up by skiff. Then, because there's a runway at Big Mountain, they are all able to fly home.
And I think at the end, everyone was empowered by the fact that we made it.
Back in Igiagig, the local food challenge continues. Moose meat dipped in seal oil, bone soup, dry fish, and berries are just some of the foods that Igiagig has been dining on for the last few weeks. Many have made accommodations, participating in the challenge with differing degrees of rigor. Some have decided to only eat foods produced in Alaska. Some have resolved to stick with minimally processed whole foods. That's Kaylee Hill's goal. She says that the challenge has made her take stock of what she was eating, and she noticed a change since she started eating more healthily.
I feel like I'm getting a lot more sleep than I used to get.
The 6-week project wraps up on October 28th. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman and Rasha McChesney in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Zachariah Hughes and Casey Grove in Anchorage, and Avery Lill in Dillingham. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Raven Alaska, committed to customer safety and satisfaction, reminding Alaska that now is a great time to fly. Learn more at flyravn.com. The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers the Alaska Supplemental Education Loan for students attending most college or training programs in or outside of Alaska, and it offers interest rates lower than the Federal Plus. For more information, call 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency.
Opioids are common prescription pain relievers and must be used properly to avoid danger. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication prevents children and pets from accidental poisoning and protects the environment. Information about safe opioid storage and proper disposal is at opioids.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.